Today we have the pleasure of having Trevor Ngwane, South African socialist, who's come to speak here about the experience of the struggles there over the whole period since the fall of apartheid and so on, and I won't steal too much of his thunder. My name's Mick Armstrong. I'll be chairing the meeting today. After Trevor's spoken, there'll be plenty of time for questions and discussion. If people now, though, if can turn off your mobile phones so they're not disrupting the discussion. If people can, there's plenty of seats up the front and the side, and that there's still people coming in, so if we cannot fill all the seats at the back so they can grab one. And there'll be a few other announcements, but I'll get Trevor to take it away.
Amanda!
Me too!
Okay, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Comrade Mick. Thank you for attending this session. I'll be talking about the current upset and struggle in South Africa. It's mainly about strikes and what we call community protests or community uprisings. But there's also student strikes, you know, student nurses going on strike. Indeed, even, you know, last time I saw some owners of driving schools marching for some reason or other. So everyone is actually taken to the street when they feel aggrieved. But just to lay the ground, I want to comment that capitalism is an unstable social system. South Africa is a capitalist economy. When we got rid of apartheid, capitalism continued. So capitalism is full of contradictions. For example, or mainly, that between collective production and private ownership. Also, the contradiction between, you know, immense wealth and a lot of poverty. So, also, we know it's got booms, busts, upswings, downswings, and then sometimes struggle also goes along the same way. There are times of upsurges and times of lull, when no one is fighting or fighting visibly, or where class struggle, the rate of class struggle goes down. But of course, we know it's not an endless cycle of mobilization, demobilization. You know, sometimes, like in the earlier sessions in this room, you know, we heard about the Russian Revolution. So I believe, you know, in Russia, there were upswings, downswings, but one upswing actually was resolved, you know, into the working class taking power. In South Africa, we had upswings, downswings, and one big upswing was resolved through getting rid of apartheid and ushering in democracy. So, and an upset happens when workers, when ordinary people, you know, they become more willing to fight back. So you have more strikes, more demonstrations, more class confrontations. So in South Africa, this has been happening over the years. As you know, South Africa was colonized by the British, at least in the Cape. Also, we had a settler community, the Afrikaners. So since the days of colonization, there have been struggles, moments of upset, downswing. One of the most prominent strikes in our history was in 1922, when white mine workers, you know, launched a rebellion against the capitalist system. And then later, we had in the 20s, the Communist Party linking up. There was a trade union called the Industrial and Commercial Union around about 1925-26, and there were upsurges in struggle. And then another significant upset was in the 50s. Now, in the 50s, the ANC, the African National Congress, which is now the ruling party, led a campaign later joined by the Pan-Africanist Congress, which was a split from the ANC, called the Defiance Campaign. So people were defying apartheid, defying pass laws. You know, you had to carry a pass And then this culminated in what is called the Sharpeville Massacre, when 69 people were shot dead by the police. This happened on March 21. And till today, it's a holiday in South Africa. It's called Human Rights Day. After the Sharpeville Massacre, which took place in 1960, it was the Sharpeville Massacre. Nelson Mandela, Robert Sobukwe, and all the great leaders of the time were sent to jail, to Robben Island. After 1960, there was a great lull. And then this lull was actually going hand in hand with what we call the turn to arms struggle. The ANC and the PAC, both leading the struggle, and the Communist Party, of course, decided to take up arms. But that led to about a period of 15 years where nothing was happening on the ground. There was a lot of repression and not much mass mobilization. And then in 1973, there was an unexpected strike wave in Durban, which is a coastal town. And this was to do with, from 1960, during the great repression of apartheid, there was a boom. The capitalists made a lot of money. And in fact, manufacturing expanded. So they developed a working class. And in 1973, they stood up and said, we demand better working conditions. We demand better wages. And then that was followed by the famous student uprising in 1976, June 16. And there's one youngster who got killed, Hector Peterson, who is an icon and a martyr of that struggle. So then in 1984 to 1986, there was a huge upsurge in struggle. And that is the upsurge which actually led to apartheid relenting and releasing Nelson Mandela and agreeing to a democratic dispensation. That upsurge happened between 1984 and 1986. And during that time, there was a call for what is called, what we call then, people's power. And then in 1985, the Union Federation, COSATU, the Congress of South African Trade Unions, was formed, and people's power soon became a demand for workers' power. And during that time, almost everyone talked about socialism. And even the petty bourgeois leadership were talking about working class leadership of the struggle. So this is 84 to 86. The slogan from Lusaka, from the ANC in exile, was make the country ungovernable, But in a way, this was a bit of a contradiction, because inside the country, people were building people's power, workers' power, forming street committees, forming organizations, which in a way were taking over the role of the state. But in any case, that was 84 to 86. So after that, 1990, Mandela came out, all the political organizations were unbanned, and then in 1994, we had our Uhuru, independence. We had the vote, and Nelson Mandela became the first democratically elected president, black president in South Africa. So I'm going to concentrate on the period after we got our independence. Yeah. Now, when we look at the struggles after independence, obviously, when we got our independence, there was this lull. People were told, we are now free. The struggle is over. Relax. Sit back. Mandela, the Messiah, will deliver the goods. So for a while, things were kind of quiet. Indeed, Mandela, I remember Joe Slovo, who was still alive then, the leader of the Communist Party, he was saying, no strikes. If you strike, you are going to undermine, our economy. So workers were discouraged from striking for their rights. Now, I can identify maybe, for argument's sake, three phases or three kind of waves of struggle since we got our independence in 1994. The first one, after that lull of 94, I think it was 94, 95, 1996, the ANC government changed tack. You know, we had a mildly redistributive economic policy called the Reconstruction and Development Program. And Mandela won the election in 94, you know, to install the first democratic government based on that program. It was called RDP for short. Even a child knew about the RDP because the RDP was going to be the program which was going to roll back the legacy of apartheid and actually, you know, give us a better life for all. But in 1996, the ANC government dropped that RDP and adopted a new macroeconomic policy called the Growth, Employment and Redistribution Program. Don't worry, they always, you know, like Stalin, 1984, they put redistribution, but actually it was taking from the poor to the rich. And that program was written together with the World Bank. Yeah, and some senior professors in conservative universities like Stellenbosch. Okay, in any case, after that, there was kind of a slowdown in what in South Africa is called delivery. Remember, we were told, sit back, relax, Mandela will deliver the goods. Can you see? So people are demanding delivery. So when they adopted a pro-capitalist, pro-bourgeois strategy, there was a slowdown in the number of water connections being made, a slowdown in the number of electricity connections being made, a slowdown in the number of houses being built. Indeed, Joslov, who was still alive and the housing minister at that time, he now invited the private sector to actually help provide houses for the poor. The RDP, its popular slogan was people-centered, people-driven development. And then this new macroeconomic policy, which was basically a trickle-down model, said, you know, development will be driven by foreign investment, by capital, by the bosses. So this is what happened. And then COSATU, the Congress of Southern Trade Unions, is in a formal alliance with the Communist Party and the ruling party, the ANC. COSATU complained about, you know, this dumping of the RDP, but because their hands were tied, being part of the government, the alliance and all that, they didn't really fight hard enough against this change, this rightward shift. In fact, I remember quite well, we used to joke and say, you know, COSATU strikes are annual general meetings because they would strike one day, once a year. They did that for 4 years in succession. And if they're going to strike, like today, it's April the 2nd, I think, they'll say, we'll strike in December, you know, sort of give the bosses enough time to stockpile and be ready. Because Mandela, from his own mouth, said, comrades, from now on, strikes must be non-disruptive. So you're going to have a strike which is not disruptive. Yeah. Okay. And then, of course, communities, you know, started fighting back. But at that time, you know, Mandela was so strong and, you know, the independence, honeymoon, the excitement was still high. So the authorities, the government could easily dismiss those community protests. They were called popcorn protests. Or mushroom, you know, they pop out there, we don't know what they're about, you know, they were ridiculed, actually. And then the new government came up with a new strategy of dealing with protests, basically containing them through routinization. So every protest took the form of a march. You had to sit down with the cops before your protest, you know, work out the route, you're gonna meet at 10 o'clock, by 11 o'clock, you finished, you're going to march this way and that way, and then you have to hand over a memorandum of demands. So people were fighting that way, but that was entirely ineffective, and the ANC continued implementing, you know, gear that pro-capitalist policy. Part of that policy, you all know, you know, the Washington's consensus, trade liberalization. So when they opened up the borders, cheap goods came in, and one sector which suffered the most was the textile industry. I think we lost 500,000 jobs because of that. They also allowed the big bosses, big companies, to take their money and run and list in the London Stock Exchange, in the New York Stock Exchange. Most importantly, in terms of working class communities and reproduction, there was privatization of the provision of basic services. So now people had to pay for water, they had to pay for electricity. Water was cut off, you don't pay, electricity was cut off. So when that happened, I would say when neoliberal policy started to bite, you had, you know, the next wave of struggle. This was what we called the rise of the new social movements. These were organizations which were issue-based, issue-specific. For example, my own organization, I belong to the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee. So we're fighting around, you know, defending people's rights, access to electricity. You had the Orange Farm Water Crisis Committee. Okay, most committees at that time were called crisis because people felt they're in a crisis. Okay, it's a tradition in South Africa. The Orange Farm Water Crisis Committee. We had the anti-eviction campaign fighting against eviction. We had the treatment action campaign fighting for, you know, drugs for HIV AIDS patients. You had Jubilee fighting against the repayment of the apartheid debt, because one of the deals Mandela made with the bosses was we're going to pay back all the apartheid debt, you know, money which was borrowed by the apartheid regime to buy guns and bullets to shoot us. So this is what happened. Okay, now these new social movements, you know, they hit South Africa by storm. It was around about 2000 until 2004. So there was protest everywhere. You know, they would have marches. Sometimes they'd have direct action. For example, in Soweto, would reconnect the electricity when they cut us off. The anti-eviction campaign, when they kick you out of your house because you can't keep up with the payments, they would put you back by force. So this was what was going on in South Africa. And indeed, the treatment action campaign won against the government. The government did not want to provide any medicine for people, you know, living with HIV and AIDS. Indeed, the president denied that there was anything called HIV/AIDS. He became the laughingstock of the world. But unfortunately, that laughter turned to tears because more than 250,000 people died because of that pig-headedness of Thabo Mbeki. Okay, now, these new social movements, although, you know, okay, one thing about them, they were also inspired, or they saw themselves as part of the international anti-globalization movement. So people like myself and other people, you know, once a year would be going to the World Social Forum, you know, to meet other comrades and come back inspired. You know, the struggle is everywhere, it's throughout the world, okay? You know, inspired by the Zapatista, inspired, you know, by other, you know, the MST in Brazil, and so on and so forth. Okay, but there were some limitations to these movements. And these limitations came out clearly because from 2004, you had a new wave of struggle. Now, instead of organized social movements, you know, having demonstrations, mass action, now you had what you are having today, what at that time it was called the spontaneous community uprisings. This is when a community, you know, suddenly just bursts into rebellion. And usually when they do that, there is violence, disruption, and so on and so forth. But let me just go back a bit about the weaknesses in these new social movements. Okay, one of the problems was that because of the, you know, link with the anti-capitalist movement internationally, some ideas came in, you know, the ideas of Tony Negri and Michael Hart, autonomism. Part of that was, you know, we don't want to build parties. Even we are non-political. Okay, sometimes they put it, we're not against any political party. Can you see? In fact, it was just avoiding to confront the ANC. Because some of our members, come election time, they would vote ANC. So the leadership, to avoid that contradiction or to confront and challenge their own base, they would say, we're not against any party. We are non-political. So that was one mistake. The other problem is that because nothing much was going on, you know, with COSATU tying the hands of the working class of organized labor, some of the leaders, you know, leading this mass demonstration, you know, got some of it into their heads. So some of our social movements became what I call centers of their own political universe. So whereas some people like ourselves would try and reach out to the trade unions, they started hiving the movement away from the trade union. Indeed, they even became a kind of anti-trade unionism. Indeed, some of the social movements, their social base shifted now from the broader working class and became movements of unemployed people. Yeah. Of course, this was helped along by the Communist Party and the COSATU leadership, which was actively discouraging shop stewards, employed workers, unionists to support and join these movements. Of course, the ANC at that time, the president was Thabo Mbeki. Thabo Mbeki took it upon himself to attack these social movements, calling them counter-revolutionary, ultra-left, and saying to COSATU, if any one of you, work with those movements, it means you're a traitor of the revolution, and so on and so forth. So, this is part of, okay, of course, another thing is, some of the movements started to depend, to rely on foreign funding. I remember when I was working for the Anti-Privatization Forum, you know, I would get a call from Oxfam. Hello, Trevor. You know, we've got some money for you. Please write a proposal. So this is what was happening, you know. Okay, we need money, but, you know, the politics of foreign funding can actually mess up movements. Okay, now we have the community uprisings. The community uprising started in Diepsloot, a kind of dormitory township to the north of Johannesburg. This township started when the ANC forcibly removed thousands of people from Alexander Township, somewhere in Johannesburg, and dumped them over there. So when they were forcibly removed, they were told, you're only going to stay there for 6 months. This is a transit camp. And 5 years later, they were still there. So this is when, in 2004, Diepsloot erupted. The strategy of the community was to block the main road, the highway. Can you see? Yeah, burning tires, putting stones. And then this method caught on in the Free State. The Free State is one of the more sedate provinces. But suddenly, all the small towns of the Free State erupted. And there was this violence. And part of the violence was burning down government buildings, you know, beating up the mayor. I'm sorry, to one instance, they killed one local councillor. So this happened, yeah. And then, shame, yeah. And then, the demand of these community uprisings is what is called, again, service delivery. We want water, we want electricity, because most of these communities rising up are communities living in what you'd call shanty towns, you know, shack settlements, corrugated structures, no roads, not enough water or one tap, and so on and so forth. Even if maybe they've got brick buildings, maybe they don't have electricity. If they do have electricity, half the time, you know, it's not working properly. So there was a demand for service delivery, a demand for accountable government, a government which responds, you know, and listens to the people. Okay, so there's a lot. So this movement started in 2004. I think, maybe for argument's sake, last year, which is 2009, we had elections, national elections. Now, these national elections installed the new messiah, Jacob Zuma. He's our current president. He's the guy who's famous for having four wives. and you know, a number of concubines. No one knows how many. Okay, so Jacob, he once faced rape charges, and he's a known homophobic guy, and so on and so forth. So he's not a really progressive character, but he's famous for being the people's president. He's the guy who listens. And one of his strategies, okay, when he took over, you know, all the sins of neoliberalism were playing on Thabo Mbeki. So he was recalled and Zuma took over. And then when he took over, the ANC expected the masses to be placated. Lo and behold, 2 weeks after taking power, you know, there was a huge upsurge of protest action. Obviously, you know, the people expected a lot from Jacob Zuma. The people can see, you know, Mandela used to say, comrades, change cannot come overnight. But the people could see the ANC leaders driving big cars, you know, being billionaires overnight. So the people demanded. So this is the concrete uprisings. There was also another movement. I think in 2007, we had one of the biggest, in fact, the biggest public sector strike in our history, when 17 unions joined hands and struck. And this strike was amazing because it involved both white-collar and blue-collar workers. It involved both white unions and black unions. You know, although, you know, that's not the way things are viewed there. But it involved a range of, you know, public sector workers. And then there were also strikes in the cleaning sector, strikes in the security sector. Unfortunately, when the working class was erupting like that, the leadership of the Communist Party, which is in control of COSATU, did not say, let us now, you know, take power or advance the cause of the working class. They used that to get rid of Thabo Mbeki and to install Jacob Zuma. They used that to save Jacob Zuma from the 143, you know, criminal charges he was facing for corruption, fraud, racketeering, and so on and so forth. So Zuma won and became the new president. So this is what has happened with the strikes. Okay, now there's a little bit of a problem. Some of the community uprising sometimes turns xenophobic. In fact, in 2008, in May, there were xenophobic attacks in South Africa. This is because a lot of African brothers and sisters come to South Africa looking for jobs, some of them running away from wars, for example, from the Congo, running away from Mugabe in Zimbabwe, from starvation and all those problems. So, and when these people come to South Africa, the government doesn't provide them, you know, proper papers. So they end up being so-called illegal. And then they end up living, you know, in the shanty towns. So that is where the violence started. Civil society, social movements fought hard against that. Now, what are the political implications of this latest upsurge? As we speak now, I'm sure there must be a protest going on, even if it's Good Friday. And at least 10 happen at any given time. Yeah. And they get more and more violent, more and more intense. Except that they tend to happen sporadically, episodically, and they are not kind of joined to each other. So they also tend to be inward-looking rather than outward-looking. But we celebrate them, but we can see some of the weaknesses. But one thing we learn from this is that the ANC, and I think they are realizing now, they cannot stop the protests. But more than that, the ANC, although it is in control, the ANC cannot control the capitalist economy. The ANC cannot get rid of poverty, the hardship facing the masses, because to do so would require the ANC to confront the bosses, to confront profits, and that is the last thing they are prepared to do. Okay, although these protests are happening all over the show, not joint, but there is enough of them to call it a movement. Because at the moment, it's a movement without a head. Can you see? So it's turmoil. It's not leading anywhere. But I think, you know, what is happening is the masses, the working class, they are opening a door. And the left, you know, the do-gooders, the organizers, must go into that door, start organizing, you know, and start putting a unifying political program. And I would argue that, you know, although some people join the ANC and then they leave, then they go to the Communist Party and then they are sent back, what they are doing actually, the working class in South Africa is searching, is looking for a way out. Yeah, yeah. They are looking for answers and they haven't found the answers yet. And in fact, the working class is also, in a way, to put it formally, restoring, taking back its agency. So now, instead of sitting back and waiting for the Messiah, Mandela, or Mbeki, or Zuma to deliver, they are taking matters into their own hands and taking action to actually get their delivery. Of course, there's a problem because when they march, usually they say, we demand to see President Zuma. So a bit of that still remains, you know. Yeah. So I would say that one of the missing elements with these protests is a vision of solutions. At the moment, there is a vision of resistance, of survival. There is even an inward-lookingness. We must get the houses. We came first. We are the boners. They don't belong here. You know, that is why you even have xenophobia. You know, we are South Africans. They are Mozambicans. Yeah. And some of the protests, some of the famous protests, for example, the struggle in Khutsong. Khutsong is a community fighting against demarcation. So they used to belong in one province, but they were at the border. So the government said, you are no longer belonging to this province. You now fall under this province. And that community for 3 years, you know, was up in arms, rebelling. No, 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 we want to belong. They want to belong to Gauteng, which is the industrial heartland. So in a way, they want to be part of the favored minority of Gauteng and leave the others rather than maybe fighting for, you know, the upliftment of the whole working class in South Africa, let alone in the world. So lastly, I would say that in order to, and in fact, another thing is these protests, indeed these strikes, you know, they're exposing the limitations and the weaknesses of the left, because the left, even the new social movements have not been able to actually give direction, to properly support, coordinate, link, or come up with any type of unifying program, you know, to strengthen these protests. So I would end off by saying that I think what is needed in these protests and what is missing is a vision, an imagination, the same imagination which allowed the thousands of protests which were taking place under apartheid to unify and say, we demand a society where there can be a better life for all. We demand a non-racial society. We demand an egalitarian society. Indeed, some were saying we demand a socialist society. But now there is no such vision of solutions. And I think that is what they need. And I don't believe that we should wait for the struggle to organically grow into socialist demands. I think they need the vision now. And when they have that vision now, it will strengthen the struggles now. And in any case, I do think that all these protests are pointing the way. They are showing that the ANC, the Communist Party, indeed the COSAT leadership, have failed the working class. What is needed is a political alternative to the ANC. I would say what we need is a mass workers' party on a socialist program. Thank you very much.